Bourbon and Brown Town is an affiliate podcast of Soapbox Production and Organizing that pairs critical analyses of media, culture, politics, and everyday happenings with the tastiest of spirits. With the occasional help of Chicago's most talented and creative artists, activists, filmmakers, academics, and social entrepreneurs, Brown Town unpacks current events, social issues, and gives personal insight into various topics.
Soapbox is a film and social activism nonprofit that specializes in multimedia curation of creative projects centered around education, entertainment, and structural social change for a more equitable and creative world. So for this episode, sit back, sip something good, and enjoy.
You own this pageant, you go over, you look, you're meeting the girls, it's like one of them comes up to you and says, Mr. Trump, you're a very sexy man. I want to sleep with you.
And what you could also say is the owner of the pageant, it's your obligation to do that. And so I sort of get away with things like that.
Do you believe in punishment for abortion? Yes or no? As a principle for the woman?
Yeah, it has to be some form.
Putting a wife to work is a very dangerous thing.
You know, you could see there was blood coming out of her eyes. Blood coming out of her wherever.
I did try and... She was married.
She weighed 118 pounds or 117 pounds, and she went up to 160 or 70. So this is somebody that likes to eat.
And now they're making Ghostbusters with only women. What's going on?
I've been drinking. I want to welcome everyone to another installment of Bourbon and Brown Town. This is David of Brown Town.
Connor Brown Town here.
And we are here joined by a special guest, Lerone Ellison. How you doing, Lerone?
I'm good, man. How are you all?
Man, what are you drinking, bro?
I'm actually drinking the bottom of my glass because I forgot to
refill. It's all right. We got you.
This is a little red label. I do appreciate it. I'm also the lightest of lightweights, so it's going to be a lot of truth being told tonight. That's all.
Truth?
A lot of truth.
I'm all about the truth.
Exactly. Truth being
no
true.
Fake news here, folks. Only truth.
Pretty much. Well, I mean, you know, don't ask too many questions.
All right.
We'll
figure it out. So this is our eighth installment, and we're actually going to be doing some things a little bit different. So we're going to do part one, part two, each one unique, and yet each one kind of talking about each other. So let's see where it goes. This episode is going to be talking a little bit about hypermasculinity and its, you know, its real role in feminism and sexism. But before we get a little bit into that, I'd like to talk a little bit about Lerone. Lerone is a recent graduate of DePaul University, but mostly he's just a guy who is sick of watching assholes pretend to represent masculinity. With his newfound fame, active Twitter account, by the way, he only has 29 followers, so someone please help a brother out. He's working with great people to offer new insight into many things. But seriously, what's the deal with The Breakfast Club?
So The Breakfast Club is a world-famous New York radio show, notably The Breakfast Club. So it's on East Coast 6 to, I believe, 10 a.m. They have three hosts, Charlamagne Tha God, DJ Envy, and Angela Yee. Here's the funny thing about The Breakfast Club, based in New York on, I want to get the Hot 9, no, I'm sorry, Power 106. Yeah. Based on Power 106, a hip-hop network that is owned by Clear Channel, that's very important to say, but their basic premise is, let's get interesting guests in, let's find people who have something to say within the neighborhood of New York, within the state of New York, within the different boroughs, but as well as that, let's get internationally renowned guests. This particular time, The Breakfast Club has come under fire because a few weeks ago they had Janet Mock, award-winning writer, also an activist and a trans woman on this show, promoting her new book, which I've heard is an amazing read. I've yet to read it myself. And a couple of days ago, and this was, of course, after the Janet Mock interview, they had a comedian on named Lil Duval. In that time, Lil Duval was asked a direct question about, would you date Janet Mock? Which brings in mind a lot of latent issues within masculinity and also with toxic masculinity. Because basically, Lil Duval's comments were, if I found out the person I was dating was trans, someone has to go, meaning someone would have to die. And when he was kind of challenging that statement, he walked it back saying, no, I didn't say I would kill her. I'm just saying that I wouldn't do it, one. And two, you know, somebody's got to go out. Somebody's got to be taken out. So it's like his immediate recourse was death. And what I thought as far as an interview or as far as interviewers, you had a responsibility to not just fact check, but keep a level of respect and, you know, decorum within the, you know, interview station, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Well, they just laughed at it. They kind of shook it off and was like, oh, hey, come on now. Ha, ha, ha. Let's not be too bold. Ha, ha, ha. But they kept asking them questions that, again, were some of these things that maybe for a preschooler or a kid in second, third grade to ask, you would understand, but not grown adults who, again, are in a hub like New York. So it's not as though Janet Mock was the first person who was trans that they ever met. At the same time, they allowed this man to speak what I would call is just hatred and anger towards a human being.
Mm-hmm.
But because a human being was a trans person, nobody in that interviewing room really held space to say, what you're saying is horrific, what you're saying is offensive, you should stop. It was more like, oh, come on now, you can't say that. And, well, we just want to know, what would you do? It was pathetic. And the idea that that is a platform for that type of conversation really alerts me as, yes, as a male, but also as a black male, to the fact that I don't think toxic masculinity at all is just one type of person's burden. But when you come from a place where toxic masculinity actually helps you, you got to call it out. And to me, just calling out is like straight bullshit.
To what extent is that normalized? Right. They have a platform. Ludovall's on there. He says this. They laugh at all, which is like to us clearly problematic. Right.
Right. Right. Right.
But how much do you think that is part of the culture? And I say that, I mean, like, just mainstream culture as far as okaying or normalizing this type of behavior or thoughts on people, but on trans people particularly.
I think for me, it normalizes it the moment you recognize how many ears that platform reaches. And I think comedians in particular, like Ludovall, for him, and it's not, I'm not in no way trying to give him like an out at all, right? For him, he's telling jokes. He's trying to get people to his comedy show in New York at the time. I'm not going to promote the show, but long story short, he's on that radio show to promote his appearance in New York. His comments are made to create a bit of buffoonery and a bit of brevity, well, not brevity, excuse me, but a bit of lightheartedness on his subject. The issue, though, Le Duval is not as knowledgeable in the subject of trans lives as he should be to make such a damning comment. He is essentially a guy saying, as a man, this is blah, 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 blah. And I'm going, no, actually, as a man, you do what you do as Le Duval. I'm going to do what I do as the man that I represent. The issue is then when you realize how many people are listening to that station, then how many people are going to click on that YouTube link to their show, which is, as we count right now, getting thousands of hits because of this sensationalism, and then sit back in their own mind and go, okay, if someone with this type of platform says this, then I am right. I think everyone in this room, since we all live in America, we had to live through, not too long ago, the moment when people all around this country said, there's finally a person saying things the way I feel, therefore they're connecting with me, when in truth, that person had zero connection with them. And we see what that has wrought.
I think it's great that we have you on the show, which is awesome, because clearly you have a lot to say, and he's a few in, so he really said truth's going to come out. He said truth's going to come out, and I like it.
I know I do.
No, and it's not even a problem. But so here we are at Bourbon and Brownstown. You know, we were not the Breakfast Club or any shit like that, because I'm just
it's like dinner time, so so technically, it would. No, we are definitely not the Breakfast Club.
There's bourbon involved, which is great. Exactly. And so here we are, and so here we are trying to do something a little different. Not really different, but like I feel like we've had a lot of these last conversations, and they've been very, you know, we talk about, you know, Kaepernick and the sports, we talk about Malcolm X, we do these things, but we really haven't talked to anything, or at least I personally haven't talked about anything that really I've had to sit with, and I've learned a lot just like sitting with it these last few weeks, like knowing that, you know, hypermasculinity is a thing, you know, like, so I come from a very Hispanic background, and so religion played its huge factor on it, and it made me very, I don't know, a certain way where I viewed that as a good thing, you know what I'm saying, like, I realized the other day that I hadn't watched any of the like the princess Disney movies, but I've seen like all the other movies, and like so Desiree made me watch Anastasia, which was great. I liked it, but I'd never seen it ever before. Why? Because like my parents, probably without them even knowing, they showed me like, oh look, these are these DVDs that you have that we bought you. You're gonna like any of these, without thinking that like, hey, I might like, you know, Snow White or Beauty and the Beast, which I haven't seen. I want to see the Emma Watson.
Never seen Beauty and the Beast?
No. I've never seen that. I've seen Mulan because it had Eddie Murphy in it.
He was fantastic.
He was wonderful. But, like, you know what I'm saying? So, like, me being in the bubble that I was and being able to get out of that and being open to being like, you know what? I can go into, like, Boys Town and, like, be cool with it. And then, like, it was a step-by-step sort of thing that ended up having me develop as a human being. And that's why I think it's, like, when people are like, oh, like, racism is an inherent thing. Like, no, like, you can stop being racist whenever the fuck you want. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, and that's really where I'm feeling like where I was going with that whole it's the Black Label talking. Wait, but like,
I just want to clarify. So you're saying a while ago before you had this mindset that you can stop promoting oppression in some capacity internally if you wanted to, like you can turn it on and off. But like now you realize it's not the case, or I just
know that it is. Not necessarily that you can turn it off and on. Like that's not what I'm saying. This is very much a learning experience for me, and it took time. You know, it took me sitting down and actually questioning my thoughts and like you know reading shit about it and exposing myself to good media. You know, like Soapbox PO. But it's and wanting to be a better person, realizing that what I was and who I was at that moment, like, isn't good. You know what I'm saying? And it's not only that. Like, I'm sure, like, both of you as black males have experienced hypermasculinity in its own way. You know what I'm saying?
Okay, well, being A, in the military, and B, studying what you studied in undergrad, and being a hetero black dude, like, how did you deal with these themes when you're a young man now and handling with your friends and calling people out? And where did language come into play with this?
So I can tell you, early in my life, like, language came into play a lot early in my life because I moved from Chicago. We were on like 71st in Wabash. We were on 71st in Wabash or 72nd. It's been a while. And plus, I'm not exactly snober. But we went from there to Evanston. Now, you talk about language, and we were talking about earlier, like coding of language and, you know, in culture. Like, it was, I remember being so culture shocked at the fact that I saw white people in front of me because I was in an area of Chicago that is just black. Like Southside Chicago has its like Irish pockets, has, you know, say other, I would say Ukrainian, but I don't want to get into like the geographic and Italian, of course, can't forget the Italians. But when I moved to Evanston, it was diverse in the sense that in one classroom, I saw a representation of people that I was not yet accustomed to just seeing, you know?
Yeah, so, no, and I got the same shit.
Exactly, right? So it was like, I remember there were times where I didn't know how to talk, not because, like, I was just stuck, but because it was like, well, every time I ask this person this question the way I would ask my other friends, they don't know what I'm saying, and I have to break it down. And I remember crying to, I was in a summer camp thing, crying to one of my counselors. At this, now that I'm 36, back when I was 7, I don't realize until now how fortunate I was that I had a black male camp counselor. Because as a young black kid, you know, you tend to mimic the things that you see that looks like you. He looked like me. And so when he asked me, what am I doing? Because I was just cutting up. I cried. I was like, I don't know how I'm supposed to act right now. You know, that was like a very, like a shocking moment. And so it taught me at like 7 years old that there are differences, period. You know, and now I can articulate what I couldn't really say back then, but having that, it's like there are differences in the world that you are going to have to recognize, or you may not recognize, but your body feels it. Again, like busting out in tears because I just didn't know what the hell they wanted from me. The other part, like you were saying, being in the Navy, coming from Evanston, going to the Navy, first and foremost, no one in this room knows, I would just tell you there is definitely a class system in the Navy, we know, but there's also a heavy socioeconomic dependency on the Navy, on the armed forces, period.
Right.
A lot of people, I hate to say a lot, but because I don't have the
percentage. No, enough. Like, at least a lot of my friends straight out of high school, like, our option was either get a job, go to the military, exactly, or you hope to God that you got enough scholarship money to get out.
And I promise you, like, still going, you know what I mean? Like, that's just been generation to generation. And there have already been crackdowns with the military about, the armed forces, like, where they recruit primarily. And being in Evanston, there was like a recruiting station right down the street from our high school, which is Evanston Township, which is like the only high school in our town, right? But there was like Navy, Marines, and Army right there. The way I got to the Navy was I first went to college but did jack shit. I didn't do anything. So when my grades came back, I was like, my parents were like, look, we will pay for you to go to a community college and then you come back in and go to college, or what are you going to do? And I chose to go to the Navy because, again, speaking of SES and how bougie shit works, I thought that community college was beneath me. I thought that I wouldn't meet anybody that would really kind of deal with where I was from and my high intellect. And then I got my ass to the Navy and realized that was the dumbest fucking thing I could have ever said about myself. So again, language and perspective, right? Like, everybody around me was doing these things, so I never thought that there was a different way to live, which is a dangerous thing. You know, it's a dangerous way to think, because when you're caught with someone else living a different life, you may just look down on it simply because you don't recognize it. Going into the Navy, going halfway around the world, just being immersed in different cultures, coming out of the Navy, working in a field that is predominantly male and white, which was an IT computer field, I started to get all these pulls and tugs that culturally didn't back up with who I was. So the way in which feminism and the way in which toxic masculinity started to come out with me, it was the idea that I'm supposed to laugh at sexist jokes and harassing jokes of my female or women coworkers, excuse me, not female, but women coworkers. And it really wasn't funny. But instead of like saying, you know what, that's effed up, you need to go apologize, I would be quiet because I don't want to rock the boat. Because the last thing I want to do as a guy is to piss off all the other guys. Like, I never considered myself a bro, but I was definitely bro-leaning, where it was like, you know what?
I'm just bro-leaning. I was definitely holding the energy, man, but I couldn't.
Jerry looked at me like,
the whole game.
Just, podcast is over. Exactly, right? Drop it. No, but definitely bro-leaning and exactly, bro-adjacent. Because again, like, one thing I learned in class was like the silence of people is tacit consent. If I know that there are trans women, trans black women specifically for me, but trans women dying because they explain to their partner that they are trans and no other reason, and I stay silent, I am no better than the person, not necessarily committing the crime, but the people that are championing that person on. If I know that there is a person who is a pedophile and they are continuously taking unsuspecting targets and taking these little girls or little boys, and I'm saying nothing because that person holds a higher power or a higher state in office, I am in a way adjacent, even allowing that to happen. So it was like, the guilt of that stays with you. So the way that it worked was I started to read. Like, I know it's going to sound like you can call it lame or whatever, but like my man, like the way I met Colin, like I'm on my way to a different place because I chose to read. I chose to investigate. I asked myself why. Like, why do I feel the way I feel about trans lives? Why do I feel the way I feel about terms and terminology? Why does this affect me in a deeper way? And I don't think people take the time. Sometimes they're just too busy mentally to focus on it. Mm-hmm. But honestly, that's where it came from, man. It was like, I just started asking, like, okay, I'm in the Navy and I'm face to face with a dude. When I explained the way I got in the Navy, which was like, I messed up in school and my parents told me I had to go to community college, but I just wanted to be my own man, quote unquote, right? His reason for joining the Navy, no lie, he was like, man, I keep telling myself if I left that kilo out of my trunk and didn't get on the highway, I would never be here. But like, that was his introduction into the Navy, was like, it's either do this or avoid jail time. And I'm coming from some lofty ass position, honestly, of had I just gone to class and maintained a decent GPA, I would never be here. It's like, well, why is that the case? Like, what is going on? And then it's like, why is it that the guys in my area are kind of anti me once they find out that I'm not from the South Side of Chicago, but I'm from Evanston, Illinois? I didn't know about class systems. I didn't know about those things. I had to read about it. So like, I read Soul on Ice, Eldridge Cleaver, and just started to get that education. Then I read about the autobiography of Assata Shakur, started to get that education, you know? And then I read Nikki Giovanni. I started reading about like just poets and black authors that are like, yo, this is what life is like. This is what's real. And at the same time, it's like, this is all I know. So how can you expect me to accept something that's different? And that's like, to me, the hardest thing. We talk about toxic masculinity. It's not sympathy at all, but for a lot of men, it is all they've known to get punched in the chest and hear, don't be a bitch, to get smacked in the face and hear, act like a man, to have a valid emotional traumatic moment and hear, don't you fucking cry. That is not cool.
And that has an effect on you, like, as a person in the world. Just like anyone bottling emotions for that long and suffocating them. It's like, it can have an effect on your mental health and, like, how you come about in the world, how you interact with people. It's a problem, and it's nuanced, and it carries itself out in very different ways. It carries itself out through policy. It carries itself out through language, through how we interact with people. I really ask for the language thing, because I think one thing you hear about a lot, and of course all things come back to Trump. One thing you hear about a lot is with everyone, it's like, oh, like they just said this, it was a joke, or they're just words. And that's you know, part of what I've kind of heard with like, oh, like Trump said these crazy things, but like they're just words. Like he was just, you know, saying this, he was sarcastic, shit. Whatever. And it's like, no, whether you have power or not, obviously if you have power and you work for the state that has, you know, you have more agency, but like words matter and words will come from nowhere. When I'm talking right now, I'm thinking about somewhat what I'm saying, right? And so like it's very indicative of what you're thinking and how you say and relate to things and how you hear things and relates to how you carry yourself out in the world, right? And so I think with the coded language, with how men talk about women, how women talk about men, and how we talk about each other, it very much implicates us in ways that we need to have serious conversations with, like we're having now.
And I'm glad we're able to do this. Like, you know, like to me, you know, it's funny, Lerone, that you're saying over here that like that you had to read about it, but this was something that I just saw by simply like connecting with everyone who I like lived with. You know what I'm saying? And like working, coming from the West Side and hanging out with like all my like Mexican friends, because most of us, and then going into the city and then working at like a steakhouse. Mm-hmm. And it was like a fancy schmancy steakhouse. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And like I saw all the people I was taking care of were a certain group of people. And it's like, you know, for mm-hmm. the most part, it was like, it's a business district. So I'm seeing all these, and I have to learn how to interact with them to the point where they have to like me so that they tip me and I make more money. Because they're balling out. They're here to spend. And so I've literally been working my whole time like serving mm-hmm. a demographic of human beings.
Exactly.
And like, and so it's funny that you read about it. Like some people live it, and like, and some people would just talk about it. And like you have conversations with people, and like, you know, one conversation can enlighten your whole world. Yeah, like, and it's amazing. And that's why I'm glad we're able to do this. But Colin, you were talking about verbiage. You know, like, and I think that's part of like what builds us and like the type of music we listen to, we grew up listening to. Like, you know, we mentioned J. Cole more than once here. It's like, you know, before he started calling bitches so frequently, like, it just, it's like, it came to a moment as like, us as men. What was that other song, though, that you were talking about? That, about J. Cole as well, though?
Yeah, this was, so it was a couple years ago. I was actually leaving the Vagina Monologues with a friend of mine, Emma Sue. I had an edited J. Cole song, Who Dat, I believe. And he says something about screwing a woman, which is obviously euphemism for sex, and a very violent euphemism for having sex, and that's another problem with how like men talk about sex is very like bang, smash, all these like very violent terms for sex. It's like why do we do that, which is problematic in its own sense. But that again, this is an edited song that was in the edit, that was fine, that was said. But when he mentions a woman's like panties getting wet, that I knew the song pretty well, so that part of the song was edited out. Her panties gonna get wet, like God forbid a woman has pleasure, but he can like screw a woman, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. so it's like very, he has like agency and power in this euphemism for having sex with a woman, but it's this violent term for it. And so again, like this is his song, but like I'm thinking more of how the song was edited, who edited, how other songs are edited to oppress women's pleasure, but uplift this violent way of how men see women.
I think the simplest question is like, was it a woman or a man that was in that editing booth? Like, who was the sound engineer? You know, like I remember like a comedian, Patton Oswalt, his last comedy special, he said something and I was like, damn. He said two things. One was about how he said that any movie that was directed by a man has been any movie directed by a man has more often than not been edited by a woman, which means the movie was directed by a woman to prove your point, Colin. It's like, it's the editor that, as our sound editor looking at us like, yeah, you damn right. It's the editor that has the most power. And our sound editor is like, yeah, say something again. Exactly. Right. Oh, we don't even remember Lerona and see. But that's the truth. Is like, he said it in a way that was like, think of every movie that you've liked, that you've enjoyed, and then go back and look at who was the editor. And there's a reason, like, even like as problematic as he is and as many issues as he has with hypermasculinity, with toxic masculinity, and with black masculinity, with Quentin Tarantino.
I knew you were going to say that.
Exactly. He's had this, I believe since Pulp Fiction, he's had the same woman editor for it, with the exception of maybe.
Sally.
Thank you.
Minky? Sally Minky. Yeah.
And may she rest in peace, because she passed away. May she rest in peace. I think before she passed, I believe she was the editor of like almost every movie he put out, which mm-hmm. means as the consumer, we saw Sally's version or Sally's interpretation of, thank you, Sally's vision, thank you so much, of Quentin's interpretation of what life is. Now, Quentin has some stuff to answer to, which I don't even put in right now, but it does deal with masculinity heavily. But,
oh, absolutely.
But that being said, when Patton Oswalt said that on stage, I was like, damn, that's kind of deep. Like, who's controlling the visual? Like, who controls how we see it? But at the same time, he also said, like, as the director, they're shooting loads and loads of film. And he's like, it's like Manifest Dictyony, where it's like, look at all this role. Manifest Dictyony. Patton Oswalt is a fuck. Look, I'm telling you right now, Patton Oswalt is a fucking comedic genius. And when he said that shit, like,
spread the seed.
Like, I don't know. I don't know if this is gonna go, but it's called Patton Oswalt laughing for clapping or talking for clapping. But he said it was like a 6 minute bit, but he said that, and it was like, it's true. Like, directors get to shoot all day long, and think about it. Like, yeah, if the camera was an extension of their penis, it then makes sense in the way you see women's roles portrayed throughout history in films. Imagine that the director's penis is the camera, and now you realize, like, oh, that's why that obligatory naked scene was in a sci-fi movie for no reason. Oh, that's why this woman character was smoking a cigarette in this seductive way. And as a side note, to this day, I can't watch Helena Bonham Carter smoke a cigarette in a movie without getting aroused. Like, I'm not a smoker, and it was like, why is this turning me on? And it was like, oh, because she knows that in this time where a scene is being made, she can keep a male's gaze. But all that being said, like, it's very important, like you said, man, who is giving us these images and where is the language and what is it encompassing? And at the same time, if we aren't looking to establish a foundation of this is not right simply because it gives me, not simply because it gives me pleasure, but simply because everyone around me is in such wild agreement, we might not ever get out of that place. Like, you got to kind of look around in a group of men and wonder, like, if we're all agreeing on this, does that really make it right?
And on this being, like, anything on this being, like, anything related to feminism or sexism?
I want to say focus on feminism and sexism. Like, if there are a group of men who are all in uniform, if 100% ever, and speaking from the research background, right? Whenever you get 100% of something,
something's up.
Exactly. They teach that. You immediately. They're like, if you ever get a 100% of something, you have to look at how you came to that, because there is something wrong. There is no way in hell. 99.7. That's the reason why all those stats matter, right? It is almost never 100%. Case in point, you can ask about a woman's right to choose what the fuck to do with her own body. You would be lucky to get 60% saying a woman has a right to choose. The idea that you get 100% of people saying, you know what, that's right, let's keep it going, that's when you need to pause and say, wait a minute, how do we get to that? What about all of our language? What about the way we perceive this could give us the idea that we are all right at the same fucking time?
What about the fact that there's no woman in this room?
Or about the fact that there's no woman in the room and we're making decisions upon behalf of women? Like, man, again, that's another 3 hours, but I'm going to shut up.
But no, that's actually, it's a good point, because, like, we're seeing it happen, you know, like, right. with verbiage itself, just like words, like, and how, like, sometimes we don't realize what they can truly be doing to someone.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying?
And there's two things I want to get into. One is just, like, people who benefit from systems of oppression, mm-hmm. us mm-hmm. benefiting from patriarchy, white people benefiting from white privilege, what have you, calling others like us out for contributing to this narrative, this patriarchal narrative, and if that's hard, how do you do that? How do you call it friends, people you know, you love, family, friends, on saying things that are hurtful? And not only calling them out, but then also explaining how those words matter, how those jokes, how those quote-unquote innocent jokes, how the narrative of those innocent jokes proliferate, get people killed.
That's right? The type of, I think, comfort, vulnerability that is required in order to have, like, I'm going to do the cliche and have, like, the teacher moment and talk about it, because a lot of my life, like, you know, I remember telling Colin, man, the honest truth is Colin is maybe one of five men and one of two black men that I can talk freely about when it comes to masculinity, toxic masculinity, when it comes to these subject matters, because I have to first, like, battle and break down that layer of protection, like false protection or insecurity, when it's like, I don't want to say random dude, but it's like, yo, I'm not saying you're the scum of the earth because you talk like that or you think like this. What I'm saying is, like you just said, think about what you're saying. Think about why it's funny to you. And also think about, is there anyone that might not benefit from that action? And how could you not benefit from someone's words? And that's the biggest thing, like you're saying, because words create policy. Plain and simple.
Yes, I love that. Yes.
Words create policy. And like, you know, we both take from Crystal when, like, you know, words mean things. And that's the biggest hit that people don't want to acknowledge, because we can say, oh, we're just joking. We're just blah, blah, blah. We are talking in the mics and in a room in Chicago. Everything we say right now has an opportunity to live forever. Like, we don't know where this is going to go as far as who it's going to hit, who it's going to inform. And just like a lot of artists, when they're, say, I want to say twilight of their career, but when they have established themselves, you know, when they really are on point and hitting, they'll have millions of people coming to them saying, yo, your work inspired me, blah, blah, blah. But it's always when they are 10 years away from the spotlight and all of a sudden their music has a resurgence, and it's because some 8-year-old kid wasn't supposed to hear that album, wasn't supposed to hear that lyric, and they went, you know what? That was the shit to me, and it started a whole new genre. Like, I don't, like, I'm not really the biggest fan of certain genres of hip hop. However, one thing I think is real is, like, as I may have dismissed, say, even Trick Daddy or even like Trina, who she's an amazing artist, but if I may have dismissed their work, there is like a throng of MCs right now who are rapping because they heard Trick Daddy talk. Like, I never knew UGK until, like, of course, Big Pimpin' with Jay-Z. Then I realized they got an entire back catalog. But there is, like, an entire throng. And speaking of drill music, in my opinion, like, when drill music hit, it had more of a Southern influence because UGK, Psychodrama, who was from Chicago, but definitely, like, would come through. Like, for me, man, Suave House and Swisher, like, I'm not going to get into deep, but those were the words that inspired a lot of kids, because something that was said in 92, and I'm sorry, yeah, something that said like early, mid-90s inspired a kid that was born in 2001, 2003 to start writing. You know what I mean? And so it's like there's a reason for that, and you have to take that seriously. And people get mad. It's like, oh, man, you know, you being too big and blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, actually, imagine if cats, I don't want to say NWA because that's too easy, but just imagine if a group with that reach like NWA, I say the East Coast version of me is Tribe Called Quest. That's always a dichotomy. Tribe Called Quest recognized, okay, what we say on Wax is going to live forever. And even though they had to backtrack a couple of their things, or even the Beastie Boys, like, they've apologized publicly. When I was younger, I'm like, fuck that. Why are you apologizing? Now that I'm 36, I'm like, oh yeah, because you grow up. You're supposed to grow up. You're supposed to mature and say, you know what? When I was 18, 19, looking for a deal, only thinking about sex, and again, only thinking about women as physical, how do their bodies, how can I capitalize off of their body's presence in my mind? That's what I wrote. Now that I'm a grown man, I have children. Again, one of the members, rest in peace, has passed away. Maybe we shouldn't have laid that foundation, because there's a lot of party albums out there that have gone to deeper levels. So as we're having this conversation now, and we are, like, say, skimming the surface, we're doing everything we can to dive deep, 15 years from now, I wouldn't want to have a kid come up to me and say, man, your words inspired me, and they show me their catalog, and it is some of the most deplorable shit that you could imagine. Because then I got to look and say, well, what the hell did I tell you? What was I saying? And the excuse can't be, well, I was 19 when I said it. So it's like, okay, yeah, you were young, but you also have a responsibility. So it's like language and everything. It's responsibility of language that I'm trying to get at, man. Like you said, words mean thing. Words shape policy. The people behind that policy came from somewhere. And if they only know a certain either genre of music or a certain group of people to be deplorable, again, that word, to be the job-stealing, quote-unquote, gate-jumping folks, or to be the money-grubbing welfare queens, now you're going to say you're running a diplomatic area, but that's always in your back feed. That's always in the back of your mind. And now you're going to create a policy to help that same group of people. I'm not going to trust that you out there really looking out for them. I'm not going to trust you actually looking out for me. If you believe your main interaction with black men is to have them as misogynists, is to have them as antagonists for violence and harm, but now you want to open up your group center in the middle of a predominantly black area, I'm not going to really trust that. You're looking at little kids. I'm going to think again to call it back. You're thinking of super predators already. You're thinking of how can I not bring this person to a predetermined area? They're already born bad. I'm trying to change them. You're not seeing that there are circumstances in it. It's like, yo, this person came from something. The language that was used around them shaped their mind state. And are you willing to deconstruct that language and take them along with you? Or are you going to sit there and say, well, it's not your fault you're dumb, or it's not your fault you're this, you're just a black male, or you're just a woman, or you're just a this and that, therefore there's only so much I can do for you. And it's like that's the part that to me is, it's bullshit. It's hard work. And when people give up that hard work, it's kind of bullshit.
I think hard work scares people, especially people who like have the power to actually change it. Yeah. And with that, it's like that narrative as far as like society versus individual, mm-hmm. right? So with that, it's like blame the individual or try to quote unquote help the individual.
Right.
Don't help the, you know, the system or structure of oppression that is right. is begetting these things and make this individual do whatever they're doing that you view as problematic.
So my question about that, like from J. Cole lyrics. To like you're saying, like, where do we get the language? And I'm asking y'all, I know like y'all are asking me, but this is my question to y'all. Is there a point in time, maybe in your lives, where you've had to go back to a person that you loved and respected and said, hey, that stuff you told me, speaking of toxic masculinity, that stuff you told me about either being a man or how I treat women, that was total bullshit. Like, have you ever had to have that moment?
I have talked to my boys about it. And, like, but my boys are, like, the oldest group of friends that I have. And one in particular, like, we were fucking around and, like, just talking shit. Just, like, because I think that's really it. It's, like, I am so used to being able to act a certain way. And, like, I'm not going to sit here and be, like, I've never been derogatory. I've never been sexist. Like, we can't. Like, at least me personally, I don't feel like I can. And so I'm here hanging out with my guy and we're talking about, you know, woo-woo, shooting the shit. And all of a sudden, he says something, and I literally turned to him, and I was like, "What?"
Yeah.
And he looked at me. He's like, "What?" He said something, and it was negative. And I looked at him, and I was like, and he looked at me, and his face really told me, I'm like, we were drunk or whatever. But he looked at me, and he was like, he's like, "What?" And I was like, "Listen to what you just said right now. Think of Lupe. That's a little sister." And he like looked at me, and he was like, "Nah, man, you know I didn't mean it like that, blah, blah, blah." And we always go back to that. We always go back to it because Colin calls me out more than enough times than it needs to be. And I'm always like, "Nah, you know how I meant it. You know I'm fucking joking." But like, no, fool. Like, you have to understand that this is a fucking problem. And like, it's interesting that we're getting these two different, like, all these different layers to it. Because like, you see where it comes from. You see how it affects us. And you see, like, not only affects us, but affects this whole other group that at one point in time, you're just like, man, like, yeah, like, You rate people on appearances or just like it was bad. And like, and I come from understanding that and that being a norm, you know what I'm saying? And like, exactly. That was just the fucking norm. It's like, if you know, now growing up and being able to like read, as you said, and like being able to go expose yourself, that's really what I'm feeling. It's like, and so it's interesting because you're like, these, all these people, all your environment, to me it really is, ends up at the individual. It's like, what do you want to fucking do about it? Like, I'm experiencing all these things. All right. Do I want to keep hating all these motherfuckers, or do I want to do something about it? Right. Do I want to either educate myself, or do I want to expose myself to these things, or do I want to just get drunk and talk to someone and like learn something?
And record it.
But it's great. And so we see it. We see the harm in it. And so we're simply, all we're trying to do is create a discussion, create a dialogue. Right, as often as
I mean, I think we are trying to create dialogue, but also have something actionable about it, right?
Because sure.
So I mean, I'm not trying to call you out either, but like you guys said, like, yo, like I was awoken to, you know, how certain things are problematic, especially how I'm implicated in the system of things being problematic, and like Lerone and like Dave, like you said, you started reading things, and you can read. One thing I said to Joe, one of our colleagues here today, was like, I can read as much like Audre Lorde as I fucking want, but at the end of the day, I'm still a man benefiting from patriarchy. So like, what can I actionably do, at least like one small thing every day to dismantle the system that is oppressive? And when, as you know, when the most marginalized people of our society, when they get a leg up or when things get better for them, they get better for everybody. Mm-hmm. So it only benefits everyone when the most marginalized people, women, trans folks, black and brown folks, structurally get ahead, or structurally get a seat at the table, or structurally get closer to equity, right?
But Colin, no, that's great. And so, like, kind of like being able to wrap this up, like, what do you feel that, like, you can tell us that you either you have been trying to do, or you have been doing yourself, like, trying to be able to break the chains off, if you will?
I think just like calling you out, calling other just friends, like men, women, whoever out on saying or saying things that are problematic, or doing things that are problematic, as well as being vulnerable and being called out myself for things that I say or do or believe that might be problematic. Again, I can read as much as I want or think I'm super conscious on whatever, but it's like, no, there's obviously blind spots. And if I benefit from this system of oppression, like, I'm going to be in the wrong. I'm going to need to listen and take heed from somebody about certain things I think or believe or say or do, right? So I think it's kind of a weird paradox, right? You have to be vulnerable as well as be aggressive in calling out your peers, or even just starting conversations about them, right? And explaining again how all words matter, and how every part of our society, how we interact with each other, friends, strangers, how we are bystanders in those very intimate and very close-knit situations, as well as being on the street, being out in the world, and calling things out, and not being afraid to be a force for good, as well as our articulating acting against policy and whatever that looks like, as far as voting for certain statues, voting for people in office, or being in the streets and protesting and doing a very radical thing. So there's very much tiers to it, but using what you're good at, using your skill set to attack these systems of oppression and however they see their face. And again, being vulnerable, especially if you're in a position of power, being vulnerable and listening to people and having conversations with them and figuring out how you can be better. Because when you're better, you can make the world better.
Can I real quick shout out, speaking of initiative, there's a group called Man Up, Man Down. They serve, they're mainly on the South Side, but basically everything we're talking about today is what they're helping to deconstruct within kids in the eighth graders and like freshmen and sophomores. But real quick, it's Man Up, Man Down Mentorship Initiative. They talk about Man Up, Man Down is a free men's mentorship initiative that engages youth in and near the Woodlawn community. So like through creative writing, professional recording, and general development. So it's open to eighth graders, freshmen and sophomores, Till Elementary, Fisk High Park Academy. If you want to find out about that group, you can email a person by the name of Frankeem Mitchell. It's FMITC. HELL at Alternative Youth, ALTERNATIVESYOUTH.org. Long story short, as we've been talking about, one, Colin brought up a very important word, starts with a V, vulnerability. We still promote invulnerability as an aspect of masculinity, and that is fucking not okay. When I talk to young boys, I tell them immediately, it is okay to be angry for one, because again, I think we can talk about black and brown anger has been coded as violent, right? Has been coded as a precursor for death. Mm-hmm. Well, he was coming at me, he was charging at me. What would you do? Simply saying that it was a black child that was 6'4", or it was just a black body coming at you, right? Black or brown body. It's okay to be angry. It's okay to be sad. It's okay to be happy. It's okay to want to cry. But if we are not willing to navigate what makes a boy or a man cry and give it the same respect as what makes a girl or a woman cry, then we're not really doing that. We're not really doing any work. Yeah. So yeah, I really think that's a great one. Man Up, Man Down, amazing organization.
And well, this has been one hell of a part. I'm not gonna lie to you. This has been super exciting. But as always, stay black, stay brown, stay queer.
Stay tuned, stay turnt.
Disclaimer, this Raymer, Lupe's, not using bitch as a lesson, but as a psychological weapon to set in your mind and really mess with your conceptions, discretions, reflections. It's clever misdirection, cuz.
So we just want to take a moment to give a shout out to the Sarcastic Nutritionist for sending over a couple more of their fancy
bourbon-oriented, whiskey-oriented coasters.
Thank you, Colin. Coming in for the clutch. Colin, what does yours say?
Both of mine say I drink whiskey because I don't like to keep things bottled up, which is super
clever.
Is that
a fact?
Scotch or bourbon? College does not prepare you for the harsh reality of life's decisions. You can find The Sarcastic Nutritionist at thesarcasticnutritionist.com. Same thing on Instagram as well. They specialize in funny food gifts, dietitian gear, kitchen stuff, apparel, School and Working Man is, as well as Houseware. And they want to urge you to eat healthy shit.
From Browntown, we thank you, and we'll be make sure to use them every next time. Cheers, Colin.
Absolutely. Cheers.
An undeveloped context about the perception of women these days. His mama sings along, and this is what she says. Because I'm a bad bitch.
For more information on episode guests, related media, and topics, check out the episode notes. Follow us on social media at SoapboxPO and or visit SoapboxPO.com/podcast.